FIS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Indonesia is the world's largest COVID hotspot in the Asian world right now, surpassing India and Brazil with the highest number of cases and a surge in deaths. As of July 20th, the day before we were conducting this interview, some of their largest islands have been placed under emergency lockdown. And this is important because behind China, India, and the U.S., Indonesia is also the fourth largest country in the world by population and increasingly becoming a strategic player and economy in Asia. We're going to discuss a lot of these topics today with our guest, Edward Gustily. He's the co-founder and managing director of Panita Capital Advisors, located in Jakarta, Indonesia. So, Ed, there was quite a bit of optimism building for emerging markets, and Indonesia ranks very highly on that list, of course. But as we've seen the Delta variant now spread quite rapidly in your part of the globe, and particularly in Indonesia, there's now some renewed lockdowns and restrictions taking place. We've been discussing on some of our videos on how we have seen emerging market manufacturing data start to turn over, some troubling signs in the near term. So if you wouldn't mind, could you give our audience your sense of the situation where you live?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Well, you know, COVID's been around now for quite some time. And for many of us, it seems like 2020 never ended. It's just a continuation. And here we are already past the halfway mark of 2021. Indonesia's current position, unfortunately, we've had the Delta variant from originating from India hit Southeast Asia. And Indonesia has taken its kind of brunt of that force. Most recently, we're now entering a week three of a mandatory lockdown, and that is to hopefully mitigate the rise in cases, which current data as of yesterday indicates that looks like we have peaked. Unfortunately, that's the positive aspect. The downside is that we were surpassing India in daily deaths and the number of cases, and it really put a strain on the healthcare system here, where we had to open up field hospitals, if you were, in stadiums, just to have people an opportunity to at least be attended to as best they could. What that has done, like in any other country, is expose, you know, some of the shortcomings of the healthcare system, the logistics, the bottlenecks, and how do you, you know, in a very accelerated way, address that. I think one of the benefits that Indonesia has had, and this includes parts of Asia many years ago when we had the bird flu and SARS scares, that hit Indonesia too. And one of the benefits that came from that was the ability to do very close quarter monitoring of both the suburbs and the cities all the way down to the village level. And so that monitoring and reporting and documentation systems went into place, which really built an ethos or a culture, if you will, over the last 15 years of addressing pandemics and how Indonesia can be more resilient in responding to them. So, you know, a country the size of Indonesia, 275 million people extended across 14,000 islands stretching from New York to LA on the equator, has to be given as much credit as any other major economy in how to address this. And so I think we're hopeful that in the next week or so, some of those movement and restrictions will be lifted. The president of Indonesia is very adamant that it has to be, because the impact of this crisis really affects the small and medium enterprises. That is the heart of Indonesia at the end of the day, and its contribution to GDP, into employment, and into just general, you know, daily living. And so we'll see how that plays out. But there is really a strong impetus to get the economy back to its activity. And this not only applies to Indonesia, but if you look at the 10 economies of Southeast Asia, also known as ASEAN, they're all in the same predicament of how do we begin to connect the inter-trade among these 10 economies? How do we get people back to work? How do we get factories humming? And that connectivity, the faster that it can be accelerated, the better off many feel they'll be in strengthening that resilience and production that's required.
You know, as you mentioned, Indonesia consists of 275 million people. thousands of islands, 14,000, some reports I see are 17,000. So whatever the exact number, it's a lot of islands, the largest archipelago in the world. So just the logistical nightmare, I would think, that comes from that. I mean, we were talking about our podcast of just the sheer magnitude of the effort to make sure that all Americans got vaccinated, and yet we're on essentially one large landmass with a pretty solid infrastructure of roads, and yet you're talking about 14, 17,000 islands dispersed over a very large area. Gosh, that's got to be really hard to get people vaccinated, to do the reporting and a lot of the stuff that we would need to see to effectively combat this.
Yes. And, you know, one of the constraints with the, you know, the vaccinations has been just, you know, supply. So during early on in the crisis, China came forward and struck a deal with the Indonesian government to supply their versions of the vaccine, which is a traditional vaccine. It's not the mRNA versions that are being implemented in the United States. And so far, you know, that's gone fairly well, although we still have supply constraints. But for example, I recently received the China vaccination. It's called the Sinovac, if you will. And that's simply because there is no supply of Pfizer or other mRNA vaccines, which the CDC recognizes. So you have to, you know, use the available vaccine or tools that are available to you. And that's been rolled out. The vaccination rate is still low here. It's about 10% versus almost 50% in the United States as a benchmark. But we're hopeful that will begin to increase simply because, again, as you mentioned, we have some logistical challenges and issues. The vaccine has been concentrated in the large metropole areas. And for your listeners, I'm based in Jakarta, and the greater Jakarta metropole area is the second largest in the world after Tokyo. Tokyo is 36 million and Greater Jakarta is 32 million. So you can imagine just servicing a city like Jakarta, but we other have other major cities across Indonesia that are being the focal point simply because that's where you have close quarters and a degree of accelerated spread. When you get out to some of the remoter islands, it's not an issue at this point in time. We call those the green zones. But Jakarta is considered a red zone, so there's a higher concentration with regards to getting people vaccinated. We're hopeful that will begin to improve, and we're seeing signs that that is. But again, Chris, it's an issue of availability of vaccines. The U.S. has recently contributed about 4 million doses of the Moderna vaccine to Indonesia, and we're in talks that the Pfizer vaccine should become available here by September or October. So that's a positive sign. So we'll wait and see. But in the meantime, you know, we're doing the best that any country can do in these circumstances. And, you know, everyone's doing their best to stay healthy. And I'll give you an example of that. You and I talked earlier about how this pregnant pause in the world economy and working from home and kind of changing lifestyles has impacted certain people. Well, you cannot get a bicycle in any store in Indonesia because simply they're sold out. People have taken up cycling. People have taken up all sorts of fitness and other aspects of maintaining a healthy lifestyle that wasn't there before simply because they didn't have time. And so this is an interesting dynamic where you have a population, which half of it is below the age of 30, now out on the streets riding their bicycles, and a shortage of supply where they can walk into a retailer and buy a bike. I see that as a positive sign because after 18 months of engagement of people doing healthy things, it's going to be very difficult for them to go back to the office and saying, well, wait a minute, I missed my morning bike ride or my afternoon bike ride or whatever activity they did. That opens up an opportunity to get this work-life balance perhaps on better keel. And for those who are in the health sector or the wellness sector, begin to look at a market like Indonesia and saying half the population below 30, that's a pretty good demographic for us to be focusing on. So, you know, there are some positive signs in that regards.
Yeah. And we, you know, we've been talking a lot about demographics, global demographics, and certain countries that are positioned worse or better than others. And clearly, Indonesia is one of those that's on the side of having a very favorable demographic pyramid, where you have the number of younger citizens outnumbering the number of older citizens. We see the opposite in China. We see the opposite in large parts of Europe, Russia, and then also in the U.S. The U.S. is a little bit better than many of the other Western countries, but Indonesia sees a very favorable demographic profile, as you said, with half of the population under the age of 30. And that's important for a variety of reasons long term, but even in the context of what we're discussing here with COVID, because obviously COVID disproportionately affects those that are older, those that have comorbidities, you know, health issues. So you would think that a country like Indonesia should fare a little bit better, as there is a bit more of a built-in immunity with younger people able to recover from COVID there. Would you agree with that, just looking at the demographic profile of Indonesia?
Yes, I would. And what we've seen on the fatality rates with regard to COVID does map what other countries are experiencing with morbidity cases and, you know, the elderly. Where Indonesia has done a better job, and I think all countries have, is early detection of COVID. And, you know, in the first few months when this took place in the first quarter of 2020, very few in the world knew what the symptoms were or what to look for. Today, I can walk behind my house and get an immediate COVID test to know where, if I have it or not, if I'm not feeling well. And that's pretty much scaled across Indonesia so that we have that early detection so that you are able to diagnose it quickly and prevent this virus from entering the lungs, which becomes a respiratory issue, which has been in the younger folks, the cause of any fatalities was becoming a respiratory issue. Now there's no reason why you can't get tested and nip that in the bud very quickly in the process. So Indonesia is still very well positioned with regards to where it is demographics. And part of that is, how do you take advantage of the demographic dividend that Indonesia has? Prior to COVID, Indonesia went from the World Bank classification of a middle income status country to middle upper status country. And that was a positive sign because it was taking advantage of this demographic dividend of the younger population coming into the workforce, being able to generate the necessary productivity and also pay into a universal healthcare system that was launched here a few years back, and it was working quite well. This COVID has put that somewhat on a pause, but nonetheless, the trajectory is there. And in fact, the consultancy firm McKinsey came out recently and was very adamant that Indonesia will move up from its current 16th largest economy in the world. It's a member of the G20, but within 10 years should achieve the number 7 status in the world economy. And a lot of that has to do with the fact of this demographic dividend, a youthful population, increased productivity, Indonesia's ability to begin to connect to what we call the fourth industrial revolution, where you're taking advantage of using advanced technologies, data, and the export base that Indonesia provides to other emerging markets. Case in point is the automotive sector has been growing these last several years in Indonesia. And part of that is not only from a domestic consumption standpoint, but Indonesia is now being used by the Japanese auto manufacturers as an export hub to Africa markets and to Central Asian markets. And that's a positive sign. The other is, in the last year, Tesla has increased its dialogue and discussions with Indonesia with regards to production of Tesla, both from the EV automotive side to battery production for home use. And part of that is because Indonesia sits on the world's largest reserve of nickel, and EV battery production requires 4 key elements: manganese, cobalt, nickel, and lithium. And of those 4, Indonesia controls 3 of them. Lithium is not in the supply chain of Indonesia, but manganese, cobalt, and again, the world's largest reserve of nickel is. The Chinese have invested over $24 billion in the nickel industry in Indonesia. And part of that is not only from the production side, but also from the smelters. And that is in line with Indonesia's approach to begin to link its mineral policy and natural resource policy with its industrial policy. And that is preventing just selling off the family silverware, that is exporting raw materials to production and smelter facilities in China, which are then exported all over the world, to eliminating the export of raw materials and using Indonesia as a value-added base of turning those natural resources into finished product. Nickel will be a huge benefactor of that. And so China has invested $24 billion. It plans to invest another $10 billion in this sector to move down that value-added chain of turning nickel into finished product. The U.S. has not invested in the smelter sector so much other than Freeport-McMoRan, which is the largest gold and copper mine in the world, sits in Indonesia. They have taken steps to increase smelter capability and to increase finished product capability of those minerals. But beyond Freeport-McMoRan, it's basically the China story has dominated. And that raises both concerns and opportunities for U.S. interests. One is their large footprint has accelerated the U.S. government to begin to look at strategies to either begin to slow down that advancement or alternatively for the U.S. to up its game in planting flags in Indonesia, which links with its drive of driving that industrial build-out strategy that the government needs to undertake so that that demographic dividend can be crystallized. And this creates, obviously, opportunities for companies within this space. As I mentioned, Tesla is one, but others that don't realize that data centers, the ability to control data and make your platform the benchmark for a country as large as Indonesia is critical. Another example is Amazon has committed to building new data centers in Indonesia. And one of the requirements of its founder, Jeff Bezos, has been that those new data centers need to be run on renewable energy. Well, Indonesia sits on the world's largest reserve of geothermal power and is now second only to the United States in using geothermal power as a renewable energy source, but it's only tapped about 30% of its potential. So there's a lot more potential of geothermal being utilized, for example, data centers and empowering the industrial 4.0 realization that the country sees and has the capability of doing. To scale investment in that is going to be a challenge simply because geothermal presents a lot of front-end risks with regards to drilling holes and making sure that you have what you think you have in the sense of what that geothermal can produce. The government of Indonesia needs to do a better job of assisting producers of geothermal power in taking some of that upfront risk and de-risking projects, which would allow for the feed-in tariff rates to be commercially acceptable to investors to invest in this space. So those are aspects that Indonesia is focusing on to better address, to capitalize on not only the financial capital, but the intellectual capital that is required still today that Indonesia must import in order to build out its industrialization strategy and drive those policies to accommodate foreign investors. The U.S. has a role to play, and we're hopeful that it will begin to focus more attention away from machinations of what's taking place in China, which is perhaps de-risking its footprint in China and relocating a lot of the industries that are looking for a new home. And Indonesia presents that opportunity.
Where would you say Indonesia sits in terms of either an ally towards the U.S. or more of an ally towards China? Where would you say that they're situated in this global struggle between the world's two largest economies?
That's a great question, Chris. And I think, you know, it might be helpful to have some history of China and the U.S. engagement with Indonesia. In history past, China was the largest economy, and it had percolated trade routes throughout Southeast Asia, setting up hubs, which today would be Singapore, Malacca Straits, which is between Malaysia and Indonesia, Jakarta, obviously, and the likes. And those are trading hubs for China that connected the mainland all the way to East Africa and the Middle East. Now, fast forward 1930s, during Japan's imperialistic expansion into Indonesia, which at that time was known as the Spice Islands, President Roosevelt commissioned at that time his National Security Council. This was back in 1936, of why the Spice Islands, i.e. Indonesia, would matter to U.S. interests. And after about 2 years, that study came back, they presented it to President Roosevelt and said, well, why Indonesia matters to the United States is that if we lose Indonesia to Japan's imperialistic expansion, 65% of the contents in Rosie the housewife kitchen cupboards will not be there. And that still holds true today. So Japan was basically relieved of its involvement during World War II by the U.S. and allied forces, making sure that Japan pulled back out of Indonesia. Then Indonesia in 1945 declared its independence from the Dutch, which had ruled over Indonesia for 365 years. The U.S. was very supportive of that. And in that capacity, Indonesia looked to the U.S. as its big brother and how to build a democracy. Fast forward today, China wants to be the big brother to Indonesia. And this is where you have some, obviously, tensions. Whereas how the U.S. has pivoted in its relationship with Indonesia is that the U.S. is now viewed as a good brother to Indonesia, and that Indonesia is treated as an equal in regards to that good brother relationship because of its size, scope, and the fact that it is the largest democracy after the U.S. And so the U.S. has a much engaged strategic partnership with Indonesia, whereas China still is looking at the region of wanting to be the big brother, and where Indonesia and the rest of Southeast Asia wants to have China become a good brother. And so this is going to take time. It doesn't happen overnight. Whether China can make that pivot to a good brother status versus a big brother status is something that China will have to decide for itself. But by and large, in this recent tension that we've seen, the U.S. has a critical role and Indonesia has a critical role to play in the region as both being viewed as good brothers. And I think that is an interesting dynamic that investors are seeing and certainly investors want and the general populace would like to see. Part of that is the U.S. also engaging other democracies in the region, Japan, Korea, Australia, and India, all stepping up their game in engagement with Indonesia so that there is this, if you will, club of democracies trying to advance market-oriented economies based on democratic open principles. China has taken notice of this. You know, at times China will have fits about that, but I think this will continue to be the trend going forward. Most recently, Australia hosted a military exercises game, which invited and involved all these democracies onto its coastline for these naval military exercises, obviously sending a signal to China. China had its naval brigade off the shores observing it. Indonesia was an observer to these military exercise war games. And the reason being it was an observer and not a participant is that Indonesia's diplomatic posture has always been non-aligned. And that started back in the 50s under President Sukarno, who was considered the founding father of Indonesia. And that is leading the non-aligned movement at that time, which consisted over 100 countries, which didn't want to fall into the sphere of the Soviet Union or the Western democracies. It wanted to maintain a degree of independence between the two and see from a very mercantilist type of approach what it could get from both sides. Indonesia still takes a non-aligned posture with regards to diplomacy and wants to engage via trade and more of a mercantilist approach to how it can benefit from these two superpowers, China and the U.S., to get the best recipe, if you will, for its citizens. And I think that will continue. But I think behind the scenes, there is a very close relationship between the U.S. and Indonesia. It has a strategic and economic partnership, which is very strong from economic perspective. We've seen encroachment of China into Indonesian waters, and Indonesia has pushed back on that, and with also the support of the U.S. And I'll give you an example. The U.S. has just set up a maritime training center on one of the islands of Indonesia close to Singapore called Batam. And that maritime training center is to begin to scale up the capacity and capability of Indonesia's Coast Guard and naval in patrolling its waters from any encroachment or adventurism from China. This is a subtle sign, if you will, or message to China, and very much in the context of Indonesia, which is we're not going to allow China, or will we embarrass or make China lose face, but we will send signals that are in our vested interest to protect our waters and our borders. And we will reach out to partners who can help us achieve that goal. So these are, you know, some of the things that are taking place and the subtle signals being sent to China, not only by Indonesia, but by the other 10 economies in Southeast Asia, where the U.S. has a strategic partnership with countries, whether it's on economic or defense means. And I believe China is seeing and hearing that message. But at the same time, China has some leverage points within that posturing and positioning, and that is it will continue to advance and view its red line that it has created in the South China Sea at its territorial waters. The quid pro quo, I believe, is Taiwan. And so, you know, there's this kind of quid pro quo. If the Western nations and others are viewing Taiwan as not a part of China, and there is mixed messages with regards to Taiwan as a part of China, then I see that the Chinese will continue to advance its interests in the South China Sea, its demarcation of where it feels its territorial waters lie, creating additional tension among the 10 economies of Southeast Asia with regards to this encroachment. Those economies looking at the U.S. and other Western allies, including Japan and more recently, Britain has sending two permanent naval brigades to the South China Sea to help with, if you will, mitigating that adventurism that China is showing. This is the dynamic that's taking place. And I think it really is this kind of posturing, if you will, and at some point coming to a degree of realization that we are dealing with two very large superpowers. Indonesia, like many of the economies here, are trying to find a pathway forward that they can maintain engagement with both for their own economic interests and geopolitical interests on how to advance good relations with both, but at the same time, not necessarily falling into one camp or the other, because they believe that could also trigger blowback with regards to export markets that both represent, how they both represent foreign direct investment into their markets that is still needed, both from financial and intellectual capital, and maintaining a degree of detente or balance with regards to those interests. So this is going to be a continued focus of the U.S. and Western allies. It'll be a continued focus of Japan and Korea, because they are the two largest investors in the manufacturing sector in Indonesia. Obviously, China has a large and increasing presence in the natural resource and value add process of those resources. And then you have the technology players coming out of the US, from Tesla to Amazon, with regards to setting up data centers and how to control how that all fits into the Internet of Things, and where the US has the ability to lead and be a good brother with regards to that build out strategy.
Ed, I want to bring the conversation full circle, because in the context of COVID, and as you're saying, you know, where Indonesia is taking a non-aligned status between China and the U.S., China has clearly tried to use its vaccine, Sinovac and other ones, as a means of sort of soft diplomacy. That is clearly the case of what we saw in Indonesia, where you're located, because as you admitted, Sinovac is the main vaccine that is being rolled out and made available by China to Indonesia. We still only see about 6 to 10% of Indonesia's population vaccinated. And there are some questions, of course, over whether or not Sinovac is even effective against the Delta variant versus maybe Pfizer, Moderna, or Johnson & Johnson, which are said to have a higher effectiveness. But that being said, given your sense of the news reporting and just the general perception by Indonesians, is China playing this soft diplomacy with their vaccines, you know, the Sinovac being the main one and them supplying it to Indonesia? Is that helping tip the scales in terms of public perception there a little bit more towards China?
That's a great question. I mean, this is just from my personal view. I think Indonesia is indifferent. I think the vaccine diplomacy that China has shown is kind of a mea culpa. If we are culpable in the release of COVID and however it got it released and the spread of it, then I think China is having to demonstrate to key markets that it's invested in that it wants to right a wrong. And I think the Sinovac and China's approach to the vaccine was nothing more than a preemptive versus everyone else to saying, well, we need to be of help to you. And Indonesia's response is, we need help, not that we're reliant on China with regards to that. So there's not really a quid pro quo of saying, give us the vaccine and we'll fall into your sphere of influence. It's like, give us a vaccine because you're the one who caused this. So that's been, I believe, Indonesia's attitude toward this. Would Indonesia welcome production of the Western vaccines? Absolutely, it will. But we're not sure where those discussions are and if they're forthcoming. So in the interim, China has made a vaccine available. No one else has made that vaccine available. Indonesia's approach, we'll take it. You are in a position to basically correct this wrong. But Indonesia has also extended the branch to all vaccine providers of how do we accelerate local production of these mRNA vaccines if they are proven to be more effective in efficacy than the China vaccines. Indonesia is happy and welcomes that. But I think that has to come down to, can they be produced locally under license or in partnership with Indonesian pharmaceutical industries, both which are state-owned enterprises and privately owned? We'll have to see that. That is where I believe the U.S. can play a role. But as you've seen also is where these vaccines have been invented and deployed has been a focus on making sure that their population has first use of it and then any supplies which can be exported to other allies will take that role.
So Ed, in sum, Indonesia consists of 275 million people, 14,000 islands. It's one of the largest archipelago nations in the world. Half of the population is under the age of 30, with one of the most favorable demographic profiles in the world. That's in stark contrast to places like China that obviously implemented the one-child policy and relaxed that to eventually two and now three children. Europe also having a very unfavorable demographic profile, followed by Russia and even the United States. Is recently reclassified from a middle income to middle upper income status. McKinsey believing that's going to move from the 16th largest economy, that's GDP wise, to eventually becoming the 7th largest. And it sits on the world's largest reserve of nickel, which is extremely important when we think about batteries, and controls three of the most critical metals used for batteries, including cobalt being one of them. And it also sits on the world's largest source of geothermal power. Those are some of the stats and I think really important points that came out of what you shared with us today. Anything you'd like to add to that as we close today's interview?
Yes, I would. Out of the 10 unicorns, and unicorns being in the startup world of valuation of greater than $1 billion in Southeast Asia, six originate in Indonesia. One of them is going IPO next week. It's an e-commerce platform called Bukalapak, and its IPO will be on the Jakarta Stock Exchange, about $1.5 billion, one of the largest in the last recent years. A few others will be listed through special purpose acquisition companies on the New York Stock Exchange in the coming 30 days. Their valuations exceed $5 billion. And all of those originate in Indonesia, serving this large young economy, which is focused on e-commerce and using fintech applications and everything that if you can do it on three swipes of your smartphone app, you have a market. And I think that in its context is symbolic of how Indonesia, being a young demographic population, a culture which adapts technology from outside its borders very quickly and makes it its own version of how to best use it, is a critical example of why investors should be looking at the Indonesian economy, its market players, and the potential that I think it represents, being the largest democracy after the United States, and within the next 10 years, aims to be the seventh largest economy in the world.
So it sounds like we're seeing a short-term setback with Indonesia now being considered the largest hotspot for COVID and the Delta variant in the Asian world. But long-term view is still very bright. There's a lot of major factors and facts, obviously, that you shared with us that I summarized and that you just also labeled there that, you know, basically shine a very bright spotlight on Indonesia for long-term success.
Yes. And I said, I've been in the region now about 30 years. And so I've seen its fits and starts and its ups and downs. But during this period of COVID, when you have some time to think and strategize and kind of, you know, look and project long term, Indonesia is certainly on the right trajectory of where it's headed. And I use an analogy of where the United States was in the 1950s, where you had, you know, baby boomers and a sense of optimism and opportunity for people to grow and develop, and for a democracy that has now been pretty much set in place and where that can grow with regards to developing those opportunities in a fashion that links to the rest of the world that is very like-minded in that approach. So I believe that it's a wonderful opportunity that Indonesia sees itself in, regardless of where we're at right now in COVID. It does have to address these challenges. It can do a better job in various aspects of communicating and executing its policies and strategies to accommodate what it still is required, and that is importing financial intellectual capital to help with that build-out strategy. But of all the places in the world, I think, you know, your listeners and others should begin to see that Indonesia has become a player and it should be a part of their lexicon. And I think you'll see more of that in the coming, you know, months and years ahead.
Ed, if any of our listeners would like to reach out to you or follow more of your work, what would be the best way to do so?
I would say, you know, if anyone wants to reach out, they can. Our website is panitacap.com. You can reach us there and be happy to have a conversation and see where we can be of help.
Edward Gustely, co-founder and managing director of Panita Capital Advisors, again, located in Jakarta, Indonesia. Ed, it was a pleasure speaking with you and getting an update on what we're seeing in your part of the world. And we definitely look forward to having you on the show again. So I hope you enjoyed today's podcast with Ed discussing Indonesia's strategic place in the world. Again, sitting on the largest source of nickel, which is a critical component for batteries, as well as a number of other crucial metals. Also the world's largest source of geothermal power, which has yet to be fully tapped. And Indonesia actually has a goal of becoming the world's geothermal superpower. Lastly, as Ed mentioned towards the end of today's interview, of the 10 largest unicorns or tech startups achieving a $1 billion valuation, six of them are coming out of Indonesia. So that's a pretty big feat right there. So there's lots of important developments coming out of the world's fourth largest country by population, not the least of which is, again, their very strategic position in the South China Sea. And I want to encourage you to check out some of the links that we're going to include where this interview is located on Financial Sense that will go into more depth on some of the topics and areas that we discussed today. Lastly, if you have any questions or feedback about today's interview, feel free to email me at CRIS, that's Chris with no H, at financialsense.com. And lastly, if you want to reach out to any of our financial advisors at Financial Sense Wealth Management to speak about any of our investment services, you can do so by hitting where it says contact us on financialsense.com or giving us a call at 888-486-3939. For FS Insider, I'm Chris Sheridan. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.